David Rutledge. Welcome to the program. And first up, a chronicle of spectacular success and dramatic decline. In the 1990s, classical music was the king of CD sales. But over the past 20 years or so, the rise and rise of online access to music has delivered a mighty wallop to classical music recording labels. Well, in this two-part series, former industry insider Martin Buzzacott will be charting the highs and the lows of this oldest and most resilient form of music. Here's part one of Death and Transfiguration.
The idea was quite simple, you know, three world-famous artists coming together to sing the popular operatic arias and Neapolitan songs. A charity concert in Rome. Luciano Pavarotti, Placido Domingo and José Carreras. Zubin Mehta conducting.
Cyrus Mayer-Homji, General Manager of Classics and Jazz for Universal Music Australia.
The record was released in July 1990. I remember I was a student here in Sydney, studying piano, working part-time at HMV's Chatswood stall. And all of a sudden, this became the big new thing. I mean, it completely outstripped any pop recording at the time.
Universal's Decca label sold more than 6 million copies of the three tenors' first CD, the biggest-selling classical recording of all time.
And there was one piece in particular that caught the public's fancy, and that, of course, was Nessun Dorma.
The three tenors' subsequent albums during the 1990s did almost as well as the first. Some of them again topped the 6 million sales mark. A generation on, though, that's almost as many CD sales as the entire classical music industry makes in a year. Hi, I'm Martin Buzzacott. I'm a former manager of Australia's leading classical music label, ABC Classics and Jazz. For two generations, classical music was a mainstay of the recording industry. It not only survived the transition from LP to CD, but in fact led it. Because on CD, classical music sounded incredible.
My family were early adopters on the compact disc player when I was growing up. And so, you know, people came to see it.
Pianist Sally Whitwell is a two-time ARIA winner.
I remember friends of mine coming over to see the compact disc player, which I think was must have been 1986. And we had this recording of the Cincinnati Pops playing the 1812 Overture, which had real canons on the recording. Oh my goodness, there was a warning on the front of that said, you know, be really careful with the levels because there are real canons and real church bells recorded on this. So it might do your speakers some damage. Just try a low level first.
Sally's childhood reaction to the sound of CDs was typical of so many classical music listeners at the time.
Because I couldn't believe the difference in the quality. It was so clear. I just had never heard anything like it. So it was a very amazing time. It was really quite the revolution.
So classical music led the way for the CD revolution. And all the major recording companies jumped on the bandwagon very quickly. EMI, Decca, Deutsche Grammophon.
Today, though, CD sales are declining across all forms of music, including classical. The latest revolutions in music distribution are all about the internet. With digital downloads, the consumer buys the music from online stores like iTunes and keeps it on a hard drive. And then there's streaming, where listeners subscribe to online music libraries like Spotify and play their tracks straight off the net at a cost of just a couple of dollars a week. Classical music consumers haven't been early adopters of this digital and streaming technology. Add to that the decline in CD sales, and many classical music releases earn just a few hundred dollars of income annually across all formats. So how can classical record companies and their artists survive in such a hostile marketplace? In this two-part series, Death and Transfiguration, I'll talk to leading record company executives about the commercial future for recorded classical music, an industry still struggling to reclaim the glories of its past.
Well, I think the music business has probably hit almost its rock bottom over the last 6 to 12 months, and probably for the next 12 months will remain in that transition phase until consumers decide, here's how I want to access music, here's how I want to buy music, here's how I want to listen to music.
Sean Warner is the Commercial Managing Director for Universal Music in Australia.
In the good old days, if you like, record companies traditionally told consumers what was available and where they could buy it. Now the tables have turned and consumers are telling us what's available, where they want it, what format they want it on, what device they want to play it on. And so they're really telling us it's a pull model versus a push model from the labels.
Universal and the other so-called major labels like Sony, EMI and Warner Music control the majority of the world's recorded classical music, including almost all the great recordings from the LP era. Now, though, the majors have to compete with a number of innovative newcomers who've been much quicker to adapt to the modern business environment. Of these younger labels, none has made a bigger impact than Naxos. Founded by Klaus Heyman in 1987, the Hong Kong-based Naxos label is now the market leader in recorded classical music.
Well, it was the beginning of the CD boom. CDs had come around 1982-83. I think more factories had sprung up, there was more capacity, manufacturing prices came down, so it was the right time to launch a CD label.
Klaus Heyman speaking by Skype from Naxos's headquarters in Hong Kong. Cyrus Mayer-Homji is General Manager of Classics and Jazz for Universal Music Australia, one of the so-called major labels that Naxos took on.
Naxos felt that classical music should be accessible to all, and that the prices that the so-called majors were charging wasn't necessarily something that everyone could afford, and therefore it was an impediment to people buying classical music. So it came out with a budget label. You'd buy a CD in stores for $10. The orchestras, the performers they used, weren't big names, weren't necessarily front rank. They weren't necessarily bad either, but they weren't the Vienna Philharmonic. Their A&R investment was much, much lower than those of the big record companies that had the Rolls-Royce type brands, if you like.
The major companies were releasing their back catalogs on CD very often with short playing times. They simply transferred the LP, what they had on LP, to CD. You saw 40-minute CDs and 35-minute CDs, you know. So it was a really good time to come out with a digital label that was conceived for CD with playing times always above 55 minutes. Well, it was basically working from day one. We launched with five titles, and the day after, the telephone started ringing from all over the world, where can we get these wonderfully cheap CDs? We started manufacturing in Japan. We shipped them by the plane load to Europe.
The major recording companies thought this is just a little blip on the horizon. It's going to go away, and we'll keep issuing our recordings at premium price because we've got premium orchestras and premium singers and premium artists.
The consensus was that it would go away. I remember the then head of EMI Classics, Richard Little, saying this crazy German in Hong Kong with budget label, he won't survive. That was basically was a consensus. It was good for me because if they had released their back catalog at my price, they could have killed me right away. But they wanted to exploit their back catalogs at maximum profit. So they released everything from the past at full price. And when they first came out with a response to Naxos in the early 90s, it was far too late. We were established. The Naxos, famous Naxos White Walls, were in the better record shops. They reacted far too late.
Some of Naxos's first recordings went onto the bestseller lists.
My Wife's Four Seasons became our biggest ever-selling title with more than 1.5 million copies sold. I just took a look at our catalog. I think we now have 8,000 or 9,000 titles in the catalog across all the Naxos labels.
Naxos didn't go away. It's firmly established. It's a brand in itself. It's well-respected. It sells well. And Naxos's policy was to try and record everything. Every piece of classical music known and even unknown to man, but issued at prices that people could afford.
Years ago, I was at some symposium in Germany. I was asked whether everything worth recording had been recorded. And I said, well, if you look at the history of music and look in the publisher catalogs, you think that about 2 million hours of music have been composed since the beginning of Western classical music. And so far, we only about 100,000 hours recorded unduplicated. There's still 1.9 million hours to be recorded. Yeah, I mean, even big name composer like Telemann, you know, he composed 600 suites, of which about, I think, 20 have been recorded. So there's still a lot of good and interesting music out there to record.
Gradually, of course, companies realized that if they had to compete, they had to reissue or issue recordings at budget price. Reissues became a very, very big part of record companies' artist and repertoire focus. They were issued as series. I remember Decca had Ovation, EMI had Greensleeve, Deutsche Grammophon had Galleria, and they were all designed in a particular way, so they looked similar, they could sit together. The very first reissues came with very minimal packaging, pretty awful designs, no liner notes, and Naxos always had the edge. It had a staple design, if you like, but it always had liner notes and background notes so that people felt they weren't being cheated at the lower price. Gradually, however, budget series these days all come with notes, but Naxos leads. Sì, lo so che non c'è luce in una stanza quando manca il sole.
The advent of Naxos meant that there were cheaper prices, but of course there were lower profit margins for each title too. In the 1990s, the tried and trusted business models that had lasted since the days of the old shellac 78s now had to adapt. But in the war against Naxos, the major labels had a not-so-secret weapon. Massive marketing budgets and the biggest names in classical music to spend them on. As the search began for the next commercial success to rival the three tenors, classical musicians became pop stars, and a whole new musical genre was born, pop classical crossover. Time to Say Goodbye, sung by blind Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli, led the way.
He'd recorded it and released it, I think in about 1995, but only in its Italian version, Conte Partiro. It did extremely well in Germany and Italy. a year or so later, he recorded a partly English version, because the verses are sung both in Italian and English, and as a duet with Sarah Brightman, and performed it at the World Cup. So the recording was made around 1996, I think. But it wasn't in Australia till 1998, when SBS broadcast the World Cup, that the track took off and became, you know, the crossover anthem.
But it wasn't always just pop classical crossover that made a commercial impact. In the 1990s, audience tastes were changing, and sometimes even the most unlikely classical music could find itself at the top of the charts, keeping the likes of Michael Jackson and Madonna from the number one spot. Perhaps the most improbable of all was the million-selling Third Symphony by the avant-garde Polish composer Henryk Gorecki.
It was this digital recording with Dawn Upshaw and David Zinman conducting that was released by Warners on Elektronanzeit that suddenly took the imagination of people. When you look at the subject matter, it's about motherhood, it's about the loss of a child. It isn't exactly happy, happy music. It's also very, very slow, certainly not monotonous, but what it did start, I think, Martin, is a trend for chilled-out classics, something that you could relax to, even though the sentiment of the symphony is anything but relaxation. But, of course, you know, how many people spoke Polish? And if you didn't understand it, you just let the music wash over you.
With the listening public hankering after ambient music, even monks became pop stars.
The monks of Silos, they made an analog recording that was released on Angel Records and did nothing, and then was reissued, played by radio stations, and all of a sudden the public developed a taste for chant. This was the mid-90s. It was, I think, escapism in a way, you know? It was getting away from your daily troubles and toils and being able to relax and enjoy music. It didn't matter that you didn't speak Latin, just as it didn't matter that you didn't speak Polish when you enjoyed Gregorian chant, or for that matter, Italian when you were listening to Nessun Dorma. It was just the thrill of the music.
The 1990s was the Indian summer for the classical music recording industry. CDs lasting 60 to 75 minutes were unchallenged as the standard format for the consumption of classical music. And on them, there was music of mass appeal for audiences who may never have been to a classical concert, but who in their daily lives wished to be transported into another realm. In Australia, during the late 1990s, Christopher Lawrence's three Swoon albums, each sold in the hundreds of thousands.
It began as a program segment on Breakfast when I was doing it for Classic FM from 1994. And that was simply a matter of trying to slow the show down for a period every morning. It was getting so frantic with all this, you know, rice bubbles music, you know, this constant effervescence. We thought we'll take some time out. And we rather playfully called it Swoon, and before we knew it, it had taken on this almost sort of institutional status. Common answer of the day was this was, if you like, riding the classical version of the ambient craze of the time, you know, tune out music. We found that in fact the converse was true. It was the one time in the morning when people actually stopped having the radio on as background and made it foreground, we found that people gave it quite earnest listening. And because of that, they became very selective about what they liked. And it wasn't your classical music greatest hits type of stuff. It wasn't Four Seasons and, you know, Parker Bell Canons. It was extraordinarily esoteric, almost arcane stuff, you know, ranging from Canadian dancehall music to strange, you know, Armenian chants from the Middle Ages. People really demonstrating their idiosyncrasies when it came to choosing their favourites. Robert Patterson, then, who was working on ABC Classics at the time, said, look, if it hits 5,000, that'll be great. We'll be happy and we'll take you to lunch. And so that's basically what we thought. We really gave no attention to it whatsoever. Once they started clocking up platinum figures, which is in excess of 70,000 per release, we started to wonder what was going on. What we're amazed at now is how the success of those days would probably be unrepeatable. We didn't realise that it was probably a unique moment, and that sales of that magnitude for a classical compilation, these days you can't imagine at all.
Elsewhere, income still being generated by the three tenors and other crossover artists was being put to good use.
It cashed up record companies and enabled them to continue exploring the rarer tracks of repertoire. For example, I think about 4 or 5 years after Decca, the company that issued the first three tenors record, started a very, very interesting project called Entartete Musik.
Papa schwindelt, Mama schwindelt, tut sie bloß auf ihren Mund.
It was music that was banned by the Third Reich, by composers who had very, very sad ends to their lives or were lucky enough to escape.
But with the major labels on the one hand experimenting with the esoteric and on the other going into crossover, not all the leading recording ensembles were happy with the new directions. Some even began to break away in order to release their own CDs. The world's most recorded orchestra, the London Symphony Orchestra, led the way.
The LSO had always been in the recording studio, you know, from dating back to the days of Elgar and Bliss and others. And so in the 90s, we found that the recording world was changing and we were not recording the core orchestral repertoire to anything like the same extent.
Catherine McDowell is the LSO's managing director.
And so the LSO did what it always does, which is to take the whole situation into its own hands and to think, well, what can we do about that? And the idea was that we would then start to create our own recordings where we owned our own intellectual property rather than selling that to a recording label. And we would set up our own label, taking the recordings from our own concerts.
Other orchestras followed the LSO's lead and began to release their own recorded music. The classical music recording industry became more fragmented than it had ever been. And now the rise of digital technology meant that for the first time in two decades, the CD format had competition. Once again, Klaus Heyman and his Naxos label were ahead of the pack.
I think in 95 in the Wall Street Journal or in the New York Times that the internet was the future of music delivery, and I figured I put my whole catalog up online so people can listen to recordings and hopefully go to the record shop and buy them. At the time we allowed people to only listen track by track, not complete albums, and we streamed at 20 kbps, which was not great quality at the time. Yeah, and it worked. My people thought at the time had gone nuts because bandwidth was really, really expensive. And I think the maintaining the streaming site cost me probably about 100,000 Hong Kong dollars at about $15,000 a month. But in the end, when bandwidth became cheap and we launched a music library, and they all said, oh, well, that they thought I was crazy then as well. But they quickly realized it was a very good business model.
So for the major labels, the early 2000s saw their high-cost, CD-oriented business model coming under increasing pressure as CD sales began to decline.
I think the CD being such a permanent medium, relatively indestructible, meant that by the time you got into the mid-2000s or so, people had virtually replaced their LP collections. They had not only new recordings, but they also had their favorite reissues. But at that time, people didn't need to necessarily replace recordings. And it was about this time that digital technology started taking off. Why have physical encumbrance, load up your shelves to creaking point, when you could have it all in the air, so to speak?
And now it was becoming cheaper to make a recording too.
At the same time, I must say the cost of recording dropped dramatically. Orchestras now are quite willing to record without a fee just to be in the market. In many cases, you only have the production cost. It means the artistic director and the engineer of the recording, and everything else is free.
Nobody gets paid a fee up front for the session. We just record the concert, then we issue the recordings, then we share the profits.
Led by Naxos, new, agile and innovative small labels began springing up everywhere. Retail prices dropped, and at the same time, the big computer companies were developing products that brought online music distribution not just to computers, but to portable devices as well. Classical music lovers were initially reluctant to embrace the digital technology. But they, like everyone else, soon discovered that the music they loved had never been more accessible. It was not only cheaper, but in fact, much of it was free. For the major classical CD labels, the good times were ending, and the heady days of the three tenors were becoming a distant memory. For those labels still solely reliant on the sale of CDs, there would now be either death or transfiguration.
Martin Buzzacott with part one of his two-part series on the life and near-death of the classical music recording industry. The sound engineer was Phil McKellar, and in part two, Martin will be looking to the future and finding some surprising signs of optimism for recorded classical music. That's next week on Earshot, and of course Earshot is where you happen to be right now with me, David Rutledge, here on RN.